Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. Little Revolution, which played at the Almeida Theatre in September 2014, was the result of verbatim playwright Alecky Blythe's reportage during the London riots 3 years earlier. Dismissed by a number of mainstream critics for failing to illuminate that event, the play and Joe Hill Gibbons' disrupted, disjointed production actually set out to explore its own failure in that regard. Broadly speaking, this wasn't Blythe's or mainstream theatre's story to tell, and Little Revolution argues that telling it takes ownership of the riots and frames them in establishment terms. Doing so means nothing, or nothing much, has changed as a result. So Alecky, Joe, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Alecky, let's start with you. That Monday night in August 2011, what made you run out into the streets with your dictaphone in hand?
I had gone out the day before to Tottenham, and witnessed the aftermath and the devastation, and just saw that it was something that clearly everybody was talking about, and I just wanted to I just found it so extraordinary that this could be going on in this city, in that year, that I wanted to talk to people about it, and it seemed that it was very much something that people were trying to make sense of, but obviously not being able to. So I got a few sort of bits and pieces, and then I heard that it was sort of spreading, and I actually heard it was spreading to Brixton. So I went to Brixton, but I only got so far because the tubes were down, because it was all happening in South London. So I got out the tube at Stockwell, and my mum had actually phoned me going, "Oh, darling, oh, I hear the riots are spreading to Hackney." And I was like, "Oh, excellent." So I got back on the tube.
Because she was trying to stop you.
Yeah,
she was trying to save you, wasn't she?
She was worried about me because that's where I live. So I think she thought, "Oh my God, I know she'll be out, so I don't want her going out." So stupidly told me that that's where it would be. So I kind of got back, and I was more comfortable going around Hackney, as that's the kind of area I'm more familiar with. I was kind of thinking, oh, kind of Brixton, I don't know it so well, so it's slightly, you know, less unfamiliar territory. So I thought, okay, that's really good. So what I actually did is I sort of went home, because it's quite a big thing to go, oh yeah, I'm going to go into the thick of it. It's one thing going the day after, like when I went to Tottenham, I was sort of just like putting my toe in the water, you know. But to actually kind of think you're actually going to go into it does take a little bit more thinking about and consideration. So I actually went home and probably watched it on the news for a couple of hours and just thought, oh, girl, and was trying to work out where it was and that kind of thing. And I was like, yes, come on, I've got to go. There's this weird sort of push and pull when something like this happens, and I'm sort of there going, oh, I'm mad to go and do this. But then obviously the sort of the adventurer or the writer side of me is kind of going, come on, get out there.
So how did that feeling then relate to when you went up for Come Out Eli, how many years before? Was there a difference to the two?
There was a difference because there wasn't violence so evidently going on in front of me like the riots. But in a way, that was probably the same sort of spirit, the same adventurous spirit in me that, if you like, that was sort of working then, because I had just moved to Hackney then. And was sort of unfamiliar with the area, didn't really know what I was sort of getting into, and hadn't necessarily gone out with my microphone in kind of public like that. So I suppose there was something in me then that is the same thing that sent me out in the riots. But I would say the riots, and actually I did spend some time at Dale Farm, and was there the day that eviction happened. I would say those two were probably the sort of the most unwieldy situations that I've got myself in. And I, you know, I should say I'm not, I would sort of see other reporters getting much more involved. I'd be like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not that, you know, I don't have a a hard hat and a sort of film full metal jacket type. You know, I'm just out on my own, and I sort of see other reporters, and they're maybe in crews, so maybe that kind of gives them more kind of courage to sort of go maybe deeper into it. I kind of venture as far as I dare, really. And I suppose with the rights, it got to a point where I nearly got mugged, and then I thought, okay, I'm going now. I could have stayed. Maybe some people would have stayed. Maybe others obviously wouldn't have gone out in the first place. But yeah, you just I don't know. It's just a kind of instinctive thing.
And it was 3 years, obviously, from that day to the premiere of Little Revolutions. Yeah. In the interim, as I understand, you were working on a BBC documentary.
Yes.
That was very different to Little Revolution, and Little Revolution perhaps came out of that.
Yeah, it was very different. It was, I mean, I'd worked quite a bit on Little Revolution. It wasn't Little Revolution at the time. It was just sort of my rights piece. And then the opportunity to make a green-lit piece for BBC Two came up, but not using my material. So even though Rupert was actually interested in the show, my rights show, at the time, I sort of had to choose whether I wanted to make a play of my material or go with a greenlit, you know, BBC Two drama that I was excited about the idea that, you know, I could get the recorded delivery technique on screen. I would be able to co-direct it, so it would be using the sort of earphone technique. Those things sort of pushed my buttons, so I sort of thought, oh, okay, I'm going to go with that. And I sort of couldn't look at all the material before I made the decision. I sort of read some samples, and what it was material that at the LSE and the Guardian had paired up, and they did a survey reading the riots, and it was interviews with kids who were involved, some of them who got arrested, some of them who didn't, and they had employed various interviewers from different walks of different backgrounds. They weren't all journalists. Some of them were sort of youth workers who had sort of ins, who'd be able to have kind of connections with people who did get involved. So that was definitely the stories of the rioters. Maybe that's the play that you mentioned earlier that maybe some of the critics wanted me to make. But I felt that I'd sort of addressed that quite a lot with the piece for BBC Two. So yes, that was the first time, and probably the last time I would edit other people's material. There were sort of limitations I found slightly frustrating with working with material that I hadn't collected, partly in the fact that, oh, I wish they'd asked this question, not that question. And also something about not having experienced the real life people myself was frustrating, even though I was working with the audio and you get a lot from the voice.
So how did that experience then bubble into Little Revolution as was?
So Little Revolution was sort of, I couldn't really do the two because at the time Rupert was at Headlong, I think he sort of wanted the show sort of there and then, and likewise the rights piece had to be turned around quite quickly. So I sort of chose to see how the technique would work on TV, and shelve my material. And then really, because I talked about the angle that I'd gone down with Little Revolution to Rupert, once he'd taken over the Almeida, I'd said to him, you know, it's not really the piece that I had started working on wasn't really about the riots and the causes. The story that I really started to follow there were the sort of the cracks, if you like, and the tensions within the community. And it really looks at the class divisions, and the riots as sort of the catalyst that, to me, even though I live in that area, made me much more acutely aware of sort of tensions between these two sides of the street. So I think once then he was in place at the Almeida, that was something that really chimed with him in terms of that theatre and that area, which had gone through a gentrification and is now, you know, really quite gentrified. Mm. And Hackney, if you like, is going through it. Mm. So as the play went in that direction, he was very keen to get it on at the Almeida. So that's really how that sort of came about. And then obviously just to try and put it on around the time that the riots happened.
Mm. And within that then, this kind of aesthetic of failure comes out of the piece, this sense of you as verbatim playwright chasing after the story on the
yes.
night and kind of struggling to pin it down.
Yes.
Which brings me over to you, Jo, and that must be catnip for a director like you, who likes, I think someone called you the maestro of failure.
I like failure, too. Is that what you mean? The maestro of failure. What did they say, the maestro of...
Someone said the maestro of the broken and fragmented.
Great. That sounds good. Yeah, I mean, you're right. That was, in a way... You're right. That was the element, in a way, that attracted me the most, perhaps, because, you know, I remember from when Alecky first told me about it, and what I quite liked about it, you know, even from the first conversation, even before I'd heard any of the material, was getting a sense of this was a piece of theatre that was had a political dimension or a social dimension to it, but it was also kind of questioning its own validity, really. You know, it's sometimes it's a challenge for theatre, or a problem with theatre, that, you know, it sometimes theatre is made about social injustice or political injustice or suffering or poverty or different types of injustice, and often it's made by middle class people, and it's made by people who are, most of them are white, a lot of them are men as well, and sometimes you kind of think, well, when theatre can be a little bit earnest and self-righteous about social injustice, you kind of think, well, I'm not really sure, you know, as also there's a lot of people in the audience middle class as well, so you kind of go, I guess get pissed off sometimes when theatre can be overly sort of self-righteous and earnest, and you sort of think, well, I'm not really sure this is your story to tell, or who are you to say it feels like this, or, you know. And often what can happen as well, which is a problem which a lot of people are trying to address, but it's not easy, is sometimes you'll have actors or characters on stage who might not be white, might be from more disadvantaged backgrounds, but then actually behind the scenes, the people programming it, people like me directing it, person who's written it, are much more sort of middle class and relatively privileged. So, but there's a thing in Little Revolution where, you know, as Alecky says, it starts off at the riots on the streets in Hackney, and then it goes, then what a group of people that Alecky got in with and followed their story was a group of middle class people who live around the corner from the kind of epicenter of the riot, but they kind of live in you know, really expensive houses. Mm. And these middle class people feel part of, you know, the community and Hackney, and wanted to kind of have a response to the riots, and they launched a campaign to raise a lot of money for a guy whose corner shop was smashed up, and that was one of the central stories, was this campaign to raise money to get this guy's shop reopened, and they raised like 30,000?
Yeah, they raised 50,000, 30,000 of which went to Shiva, and then the rest, I think, went to other shops that were affected in Hackney.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, and they raised that in like 10 days. Yeah. £50,000, reopened this guy's shop, and they also organised a street party, like a tea party, on the road, this road, Clarence Road, where the centre of the riot had been. But
You know, these middle class people doing it, particularly these characters called characters in the show, they're real people, of course, in real life, Sarah and Tony, were very, I think intelligently self-reflexive about that and saying, we feel we're part of the community, we want to help the community, we want to take action in the community to kind of attempt to heal it in some way because of this, the riot that had gone on and the scary violence that have happened. But they're also going back, is it okay for us to do this, or who are we to do this, or their legitimacy to do this, because they're white middle class people who live in an incredibly expensive house.
Yeah.
And so inherent in that story was a bigger reflection of the act of making theatre, really, that we were making a show about the riots.
Mm.
But Alaki, which of course you made no attempt to disguise in the show, because Alaki was in the show and played herself in the show, is white and middle class, and so am I. So kind of we're a bit like
The people, Sarah and the Tonys.
Yeah, the people organising the tea party and and the raising the money for the corner shop. We're trying to make this sort of public, this piece of art, which is about public, political, social issues.
Yeah, connection.
But at the same time, who the fuck are we to talk about this stuff? I mean,
one of the most extraordinary sort of, I suppose, sounds to come out of this show was your laugh, which comes through the piece, through the recordings, and is kind of it feels very like a mea culpa in many ways the whole way through, because there's something about you performing that laugh over and over again, and it's quite a particular laugh as well.
Yes, yeah, well, there are varieties, I think, of laughs within it. And I did have kind of concerns as the process went on. One of the notes I was sort of getting back from Joe and from Rupert was, we need more Alaki, we need more of your story, which meant more text of me, and inevitably more text means more laughs. It wasn't quite late in the sort of stage, I was kind of like, gosh, there's quite a lot of Alaki laughs here. And to actually be, obviously because I'm on the inside of it, so I kind of couldn't hear it from the inside, watch it from the outside. But I was, because it's like, oh, is there too much of this? Does it become? But that's sort of the point, because I suppose my laugh works on lots of different levels, and I'm aware that when I do my interviews, there is a particular side of me that I maybe, it's not fake, but it's a side of me that I might accentuate to hopefully help make people feel at ease. And I suppose laughter is one of the things that I use, just sort of seems to kind of naturally kind of come out. And maybe sometimes I'm generally nervous, other times it's to try to put other people at ease. So yes, there is a lot of laughter there. Yeah.
The other thing that I think is beautifully wrought about the piece is its rather quiet fascination with language, in all sorts of intricate ways. This sense that of who gets to talk to the media, and kind of who gets to pin down this story in what terms. And there are all sorts of, in the recordings that you picked, of really nuanced understandings of that, from Siva's name being mispronounced by people, from people speaking on his behalf, trying to define him, all the way to a poet who happens to walk into the street poet and have his rhymes snatched off him and an alternative suggested. It was an extraordinary sort of actual piece of thematic writing, I suppose.
Yes, well, I mean, and the character, Colin the barber says, right at the end, that they didn't hear the voice of the people, so why should they now listen to the police on the steps trying to sort of give their statement? They are right to drown him out.
This was after the Mark Duggan verdict.
That's right. Yes, after the verdict, in the same way. Another character, Sadie, describes the riots as a cry of pain. So, I suppose that the riots was a sort of physical embodiment of them not having their voices heard, really. And the play was really about me sort of trying to get those voices, and like you said, failing, really. And what's sort of interesting is people, Ian McNeil, his partner, who's the designer of the show, and his partner, who is a composer, said how lyrical and musical the piece was. And I sort of thought, oh, it's interesting, after London Road, that was a musical, and this, there wasn't any music in it. But that is, I mean, I suppose that is kind of fundamental to the way that I edit. I don't edit from the page. It's not that it's sort of transcribed and then I sort of sit with pieces of paper putting lines through it. I edit from the sound files, and I'm sort of very much, even though I can't sort of sing a note, I think I have maybe got a musical ear, because I am listening to that end. That's clearly an end point, and it sounds good rubbing up next to that next phrase or whatever. So I suppose that's something to do with the way it's made,
and
which is the fact that it's cut from sound.
Verbatim, particularly recorded delivery, which allows a focus on the oddity of language as well, the way that
yes.
we speak rather than the way that we write.
Yes, and I just
really
love that. I just find it so sort of revealing, to the point of it being, you know, excruciating, and being in the show every night, reliving those scenes that I sort of witnessed, and sometimes I wasn't just a sort of a passive, sometimes I was sort of actively, you know, engaged in them. And you could sort of, in the sort of inability of people to sort of articulate, to me there's so much going on underneath that, that, yes, I couldn't write it, and that's why it's so important that it's that the actors stick to the delivery of it, because in that, and when the actors got really, really good at it, that's when the scenes really started to work. And it was a while in rehearsals until that happened, because so much of the material is really difficult, and you know, probably some of the most difficult stuff that of any of my shows, because it was recorded at a riot, or it was recorded at a tea party, or you know, there were a lot of group scenes there where maybe, you know, the recording device is sort of in one corner of the room, and then the quietest character would be sitting furthest away from it, and it was sort of excruciating, sort of trying to unpick some of those scenes. The stop and search scene with the police, where you have two arguments overlapping at the same time, so you've got sort of two policemen in arguments with two men, and so that's actually eight voices that the actors are having to deal with, because they've got four voices that they're hearing in their earphones, and then the four of them on stage all overlapping each other.
But also there's a moment where you forget to turn the dictaphone on,
yes.
which kind of serves again this brilliant sense of who's actually in charge of this retelling of this narrative, rather
yes.
beautifully, the pips.
Right. Yes. It is my experience of it, isn't it? Which, you know, there are limitations within that. I'm going as far as I'm daring myself to go.
Sure. In terms of the sort of fragmentary, difficult nature of this piece, you used a number of techniques, I suppose, to exacerbate that in the staging of it. Talk us through some of that just gave more of a broken, fragmentary feel to the event.
I suppose the main thing we did, in a way, was sort of break the theatre, in a way, really. I mean, in that we, Ian McNeil and I worked on a design that kind of reconfigured the Almeida Auditorium a little bit, and this really came from, you know, what we did is we kind of we didn't really have a conventional kind of stage area, but we kind of wrapped, put a lot of audience in and amongst the action. So kind of where the stage normally is in the Alameda, we put lots of audience around the back wall, and we put lots of audience in the areas where the actors were acting too. So it became a bit of a sort of a jumble in that way. And that really came from the idea, you know, that there's a lot of theatre, and this is no bad way to make theatre, but a lot of theatre is about creating a kind of imaginary or kind of fictional reality, and the audience sit there and the lights go down and the audience sit in the dark and pretend they're not there, and you look in through a little window at a little imaginary world. And it felt like that was the really completely the wrong thing to do with this show, because it wasn't about it wasn't set in an imaginary time or place, you know. It was set in London, where we are, and really you know, what is the show about? It's really about a sense of community, and it's really about questioning what does community mean, and does community exist in London? So it's really about people who live in London. So, you know, we kind of thought, well, hold on a sec, it's kind of about the audience. And then we kind of took that idea further and said, well, what if we kind of make the audience the set? Because we really wanted the action popping up in and around the audience, because we really wanted the audience to be in focus, you know. Partly because there's an element of the play which is a bit like a public debate or meeting, and that some of the scenes are scenes of dialogue, but some of the scenes are characters standing up and giving their point of view. So one, it felt nice to have a feeling of a sort of public meeting, which is much more kind of evenly lit. But I suppose as well, it then enhances the meaning that, you know, one of the reasons there's lots of these tensions that the play unearths and that cause the riots is that people are packed so close together, and so anything that one person does affects people, you know, whether we like it or not, affects the people next to them. And so if someone has a lot of money, they might be next to someone who has not a lot of money, for example, or vice versa. And so every time that we staged a scene, it felt really nice that you know the actual image you were looking at was of that scene happening in a public context with lots of people sat around. So it felt like nothing was happening in isolation, that everyone was connected in some way or another, if only by the fact that they're stuck right next to each other.
One of the rather fascinating components, I suppose, of the staging was a community chorus that a lot of the time were not speaking but just looking on, observing. And I mean, interesting to say that you're using the audience as set and making this sense of looking on crucial, which I suppose contrasts really interestingly with this quality of language, and the two things sitting next to each other for me felt very central to the piece.
Yeah, well, I know when I first spoke to Joe about the piece, and I sort of said, you know, there's a sort of feeling, because I was out sort of looking at the riots, witnessing them, you know, and trying to kind of follow the story, and of course there were loads of other media people too. I sort of said, you know, if we do it in a theatre, and we're talking about the Alameda, I was sort of like, yeah, maybe it should be, I don't know, site specific or something, and
Promenade was your early idea.
Yeah, it was a really sort of thing, because I sort of said we want a space that it feels like that, you know, the audience have come to sort of seek it out, rather than the theatre comes and brings the play to them. And I sort of feel that's what.
Because there's a guy in the Alecky recorded in the show who was talking about being at the riots, and it says you can't work out who's actually in the riots and who's just turned up to watch.
Yeah, are these all actors? Is it a film?
Yeah, and he says at one bit, he said the riots, well, it was about 20 people doing it. And
yeah, everybody else standing around watching.
And it felt like that felt like a description of theatre, you know, 20 people engaged with the problem or dealing with the problem or suffering the problem. And then loads of spectators who turn up and come to have a good rubberneck and a good gawk.
Yeah, and the first time I saw the design, I remember going, oh, great, it looks like an event. It doesn't look like often a theatre audience which is sort of passive, you know, because we had the standards, because we had them wrapped around, there was something, there was some element that, you know, which I'm sure there's some kind of very clever science to it, that made it look like people had sort of come to
peer in,
yeah, exactly, which I thought was great, because that's what I was feeling on the street,
mm,
you know.
As a last question, the I'm interested by this notion of what critics claim to want from the piece, and the way that it was misread. I only really have critics' reviews to go on in that. The sense that they were looking for and didn't find a piece that delivered some new information about the riots themselves, the causes, the flashpoints, the course of events. And I wanted to ask about legibility of theatre, because this language of failure, this I suppose almost post-traumatic techniques that you're using kind of need an audience that is versed at some level in knowing what to look for. And I just wanted to raise that as a question. I don't really know how to phrase it. But
I think you know, there's, it's good that there's smarty pants like you, Matt, who can come along and watch it and get what we were trying to do at a kind of formal level of, as you say, create this work of art that was actually dramatising how it was made and in a way critiquing or questioning how it was made as it went along, you know, because you can't just present these things in a neutral way. It's about race and it's about class and it's about money, and all those ingredients are, you know, play a role in how it's made and who makes it and how, what's shown and how it's shown. And if you don't acknowledge that, it's kind of a bit phony. But so, you know, it does operate on that level of being a bit sort of course, meta theatrical and theatre, you know, about itself. And we really enjoy engaging with it on that level. But, you know, at the same time, there's what's quite really great about what Alecky does is it's very immediate, and there is something very humane about it, because it is for all the kind of intellectual and conceptual constructs that we were trying to place the work in, which we really wanted to and felt we needed to, it's, there's something extremely direct and extremely disarming and very, yeah, humane about what Alecky does and the way people talk, and, you know, as I'm sure I've done on this interview, and I'm sure you've done this interview, the way people trip up on things or say stupid things or give things about themselves away that they don't want to give away, or, you know, that there's something very direct about it. So I think I don't think you need a PhD in post-dramatic theatre to get, have some fun with it, I hope.
No, absolutely.
I hope. Otherwise, it sounds very exciting.
No, and, you know, and as the piece went on, it started to find a really interesting audience that, you know, I'm not being ageist, but was a bit younger, was a bit more mixed, and sort of kind of got it on an immediate level, and they might have got it on all those other levels too. Great.
When it really was most enjoyable to work is to watch, I think, from my point of view, was when the audience mirrored the characters in the play, because they, you know, we had, as you said, we had a community chorus, so we had loads of people on stage. How many people did we have on stage?
Yeah,
like every night we had 13 actors, and we had, what did we have?
Yeah, so that's what, 25 people on stage every
night. Yeah,
right?
So we had loads of people on stage, and we needed that because Alecky had recorded lots of different voices, but also loads of different kinds of people, you know, really different ages, different races, different backgrounds. It was very, so the cast was very diverse in every sense. And then what was great is when the nights where we had a very diverse audience, we had very different, you know, ages is one of the most obvious things you see straight away. And that was when it was really great, because that's when the design really worked, because you couldn't really tell.
No.
You couldn't tell who was in the show or who wasn't in the show, and all the tensions that came up in the between the characters, or the things that were funny between the characters, rippled out through the audience, because you know they could see themselves, a version of themselves reflected. Everyone in the audience had, whether they liked it or not, their own kind of mirror image, kind of mirror image on stage.
Yeah. And I suppose what becomes fascinating about that is that rather than being theatre that is struggling to tell this story, actually it becomes something positive. It becomes the space that can hold that story quite well.
Yeah, well, that's all.
Yeah, and those discussions then carry on in the bar and people come out. You know, I like the fact that it seemed to be that at the end of the show, there were discussions, you know, ongoing, or, you know, it definitely sort of, you know, out of it and sort of continued, and maybe different people having discussions that wouldn't normally, you know, which I think which the play throws up, I think.
And but also as a counterpoint to that, you know, we were always trying to balance this thing of I guess in a way, in broad terms, a sort of positive or negative feeling to the piece, because a lot of what you encountered in the story, or in taking your record around the streets, is that things haven't really changed, and things, for example, like the riots, didn't really make much difference. Or the difference was a lot of people got arrested and a lot of people got evicted.
Yeah, the problems are still there.
But the idea of it's having some sort of transforming social, you know, effect was zero. And in a way, we also kind of wanted to make a piece of theatre that wasn't like going, and aren't we all here together as the rainbow nation of, you know, let's all hold hands, and of also kind of going, you know, this is a load of shit, celebrating it, and then simultaneously going, but
we will all go back to
pointless.
Our
pointless.
Yeah.
Well, Aleky J, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.